A cold case hit in a 25-year-old San Francisco murder, and it links the crime to a notorious serial killer.
Is on death row right now for the killings in California, more than a dozen of them. Now police say his DNA is a match in the murder of a 9-year-old girl here in the Tenderloin. ABC 7's Leanne Melendez is live at the Hall of Justice for us tonight with more. Leanne.
You know, Carolyn, in the mid-80s, committed 11 murders in the LA area, two here in San Francisco. This may well be number three. Now, I'll tell you what police have so far. A DNA sample collected in 1984 at the crime scene, they were able to match it with his DNA. Is on the Department of Justice database, so his DNA was on file. And using sophisticated technology, they got a cold hit. It was not easy because that sample is 25 years old, and as you can imagine, after a while, it starts to break down, and the quality is not the best. 9-year-old Mae Lung was found dead in the basement of her apartment building where she lived in the Tenderloin. It was a brutal murder, and she had been sexually assaulted. It was one of those unsolved cases, police say, until now. In the meantime, investigators went to San Quentin to get another DNA sample.
Inspector Toomey and I took the warrant with us, the search warrant with us, over to San Quentin and obtained the DNA sample.
What did he say? He
made no comments.
The purpose of doing the new DNA sample is just to confirm that the hit that we received electronically from DOJ is one and the same with the new sample.
Fear grows after Tenderloin tragedy, read a 1985 headline in the San Francisco Chronicle after the brutal murder of 8-year-old Mae Leung, her body found in the basement of a residential hotel in the downtown neighborhood where authorities later learned was staying at the time. But only now has the murder been linked to using DNA analysis not available back in the mid-80s. The case reopened at the initiative of a detective who, long ago as a rookie patrol officer, had responded to the murder scene.
It's the type of case, you know, as a new officer, you know, a case involving, you know, a little girl that you don't forget.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service and host of the new podcast Crime Analyst.
I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds and FX Reservation Dogs. And I have a real interest in real crime and horrible things that have happened to the victims of these crimes.
Yes, we have so much to discuss in this case. So we're going to be diving right back in where we left off last week. I mean, 1975, then the next case that we know about is April the 10th, 1984. So you've got a long time period there, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
And 1984, April 10, we know that Mae Lung goes down to the basement of her building with her 8-year-old brother looking for some money that they thought they'd dropped, and they got separated. And the next thing her little brother sees is Mae Lung, who's found hanging over a pipe below her Tenderloin apartment building, which was 765 O'Farrell Street in San Francisco. And she had been raped and strangled and stabbed.
Can you imagine? 8 years old, and you come across that scene.
And the window of opportunity that he had to do these horrible things to this little girl, it shows that he has a level of experience. I mean, to just do this and get away with it, he spent time, right? It wasn't 10 seconds. There was a lot of risk there. He had to have had some experience to get him to that place. And, well, what happened before? He didn't have to pay the piper at all, but he knew that he got in trouble. He lost his job. That was the only consequences to him. So this time, he killed the victim.
And Mae lived with her mother, Yuki and Lung, and her mother was a restaurant worker who moved here from Hong Kong in 1980, and she had a brother and two sisters. And Mae's murder wasn't connected. I know you guys know this, but it wasn't connected to RR until much later, until he'd been apprehended. It was connected by, you know, DNA evidence. they reached out and contacted the family, and the family just did not want to talk to the media. They don't want to revisit it. And I don't blame them, you know, that, like Laura says, there's no closure.
Yeah. 2009, it was linked to RR. And I think you make a very valid point there, Lisa, on her 8-year-old brother. What impact did that have? Because I think oftentimes people don't think about the ripples on the pond to their other family members. It doesn't just desecrate one or two people. It's the whole family. It's their friends. It's their community. So that 1984 to 2009, that's a long time lag. So again, to your question, Lisa, how many others were there? That was linked through DNA in a handkerchief that was found. Now, I don't know why it wasn't tested earlier. There's one dogged detective saying, we should look at this again. We should open this case again. But by that time, a family may feel like they just don't want to go there again because they've had to put it in a box and compartmentalize it to try and exist in another way. It's really hard for families, just devastating. So Mei Leung was killed more than 2 months before what's been called RR's first known murder. So even that that's in the narrative, it's inaccurate. And that was 79-year-old Jenny Vincow, who was killed on June the 28th, 1984, in a glacial park of Los Angeles. So now you've got a very different type of victim. We've gone from an adult female to children to a 9-year-old and now a 79-year-old woman, grandmother and mother. And it was her son, Jack, who found her. I mean, again, just absolutely devastating. And the way that she was left, it was so brutal.
Yeah.
So brutal, this attack. Her body was found on the bed with her feet at the head of the bed. So she was in her bedroom and her throat had been cut and her body was partially covered by a blanket. In fact, her throat hadn't just been cut, it had been slashed almost from ear to ear. He'd almost decapitated her and he'd stabbed her multiple times in the upper chest, neck, arm and leg. And she also had wounds to her hands. And it appeared that she'd been sexually assaulted. Her dress was partially lifted and her girdle had been pulled down and torn. So it looks like a very brutal type of crime, a sexually motivated crime. And fingerprints were later found at the scene and matched with RR. So again, the time sequence of someone, the victim being found to when it's the forensics process to when it links with RR is always a challenge.
The next that we know of that law enforcement has said that they think that they can connect RR to a February 25th, 6-year-old abduction and rape in Montebello, March 11th, a 9-year-old little boy in Monterey Park, March 20th, an 8-year-old girl taken from her bed. And these are all, I just can't tell you, Jim and Laura, these little communities, I just know them so well. It just really affected me reading this. Glassell Park is a stone's throw from my house. Eagle Rock. These are just little communities that are all to the east of the five. And as we get, you know, deeper into the case, I wanted to kind of ask you about that. But
yeah, so there
are the five for my UK friends, that's a motorway, a freeway. Here in Los Angeles, people call them the five or the 10. So just that took me a little while to get used to. So that's a freeway in Los Angeles. And yeah. I think the fact that they're taken from their bedrooms, I mean, that's very instructive about the perpetrator, isn't it, Jim?
Yeah, well, I was going to say these are at least four abductions and sexual assaults of children taken from the safety of their own home. Typically, that means this is a very sophisticated offender. He's taking really high risks to go into their homes and take these children. And then he basically lets them go. And there's no behavior other than entering the premises that's consistent with any of his prior crimes or any of the crimes immediately after. So this is a real aberration in terms of behavior. But if you step back and you realize this guy has absolutely no moral code. And I believe that he offends against anybody that he decides to go after. In other words, there's no rhyme or reason to his choice of victims. His victims are victims of opportunity, but that could be that he sees them, targets them, and then gets access to their homes or wherever they're vulnerable. And this is very unusual behavior because there are very sophisticated aspects to it. And that's why I believe that he has a lot of experience breaking into homes. It wasn't just the hotel rooms that he already had keys to. I think he had a lot of experience breaking into homes, testing their security, their boundaries, getting inside and out without getting caught. I think he did this many, many, many times before these particular four crimes occurred. There were most likely adults available in those locations, but he chose the children anyway. And he took them to another location, a location where he felt secure, and then he let them go.
Do you have any insight as to why he might have left those children alive, yet he murdered Mei Leung?
I have no idea. It's difficult to say. It's an anomaly we don't often see. Typically, you'll see somebody in the beginning parts of their career not kill a victim, and then later in their career kill a victim, because there is this moral hierarchy. An offender will rationalize raping someone, sexually assaulting someone, but would never kill their victims. But once they do cross that line to murder as well, they don't typically go backwards again. They typically murder all the time. But in this case, we don't see that. And that's an indication to me of an impulsivity that could be brought on by extreme stressors, drug or alcohol use, substance abuse of some kind, or mental illnesses. So it's some of those or some combination of those things that probably drives his incredibly diverse victim pool and crime spree.
And most likely another element that plays in is the victim's reaction and response to him. I was very struck by Anastasia's account of just everything she said, the detail of it, first of all, but just how she felt he was familiar to begin with. So didn't sort of panic going with him. And even though she was taken in a car and then put into this horrible room, it sounded like she was quite calm about it all. And she would ask him to please stop and to please, could she go home? And that she was quite, I mean, as a child is, innocent and just so pure in what she wanted. Now, maybe that played a role. It's very difficult to say because only he knows. But I would imagine there's drugs and various other aspects that play in here too. But it is highly unusual for him to go to a home address to abduct both girls and boys as well. But I do think what was striking of what we heard in the Netflix docu was about how similar the children's descriptions were of the perpetrator. And it is a very rare type of offence. So that being considered, and as you mentioned, Lisa, the localities and the proximity of these offences, I'm not sure why they weren't pinging for any other officers other than Detective Gill, who said that for him that it was a concern that this was all the same offender. I'm not sure at what time in the sequence that kicked in, but I don't know why these young children being abducted from their home addresses weren't being seen as a priority, because you would imagine that they should be, full stop. There's no two ways about it, because they are high risk offences, and it's somebody who clearly knows what they're doing and is clearly unconcerned for the consequence, i.e. when he says, go into the gas station, call 911, he feels he's got it covered to some degree, that there won't be any comeback to him. Now, whether that's drugs again, or whether that's he feels that he's done enough for the child not to say anything, I don't know. And it's very hard to second guess that. Some things just don't make sense,
it's
do they?
Bizarre,
they don't make sense, because we're looking at it in the cold light of day, trying to be rational. For me, his offending behavior isn't rational. It's not clear decision-making. It's reckless decision-making to some degree in some areas. If I was working this case, I would imagine that drugs were involved, because it isn't, that these decisions don't make sense.
No, it's either drugs or there's some level of delusion operating here, that there are other realities driving this person I mean, that's what I would opine at the time, given this, you know, incredibly diverse set of crimes and circumstances.
Right from the get-go, stole anything that was loose and anything that he could pry loose. I mean, his neighbors started calling him Dido's Fingers, and they call him Ricky Rabone, Ricky the Thief.
After the attempted rape of a guest in an El Paso hotel, moved to California.
He became a cocaine and alcohol addict. He lived in what's called Skid Row in Los Angeles, which is a pretty scruffy area. I mean, there are people doing everything and taking everything, and homelessness is not an unusual thing. You live in what's called a flop house, where you go and flop to get off your high or to recover. Now, did the drugs affect his brain functioning? Did it affect the way he saw the world? Probably. But it wasn't causative. It didn't lead to make him kill. He was already primed.
Well, 9 months later from Jenny Vincow, of course, you've got all these children in between, and goodness knows how many of them there were. You know, I just got the sense, very prolific, many others. And of course, if the families found the children, maybe they didn't even report it. Maybe right. The child didn't even have the language to articulate what happened to them, depending on how old they were. You know, we know this with children, don't we, Jim? And they don't have the vocabulary to explain what happened. So I'd imagine there were far more cases. But 9 months later from Jenny on March the 17th, 1985, this is the offense now of Del Okazaki and Maria Hernandez.
She was born in Hawaii, and she worked so, so hard to buy her own condo. And her sister says it just made her happy to make other people happy. Whatever she bought, she shared. When she went to the zoo, she bought everybody a panda pin, and she'd buy a gigantic bag of popcorn and divide it with everybody. She loved skiing, shopping, planning, making holidays out of the most mundane occasions. She'd been taking classes in cake decorating and flower arranging. In fact, you see at the crime scene, you see her spilled bag of groceries and there's a bouquet of flowers there. And her mom said that you think it won't happen to you. And when it does happen to you, what can you say? It will never go away, the pain. And her mother will still cry at the mention of her daughter's name.
We see this in the Netflix show, and it sort of really opens with this of Maria Hernandez talking about her account, and she manages to survive entering the garage that she shares with her roommate, Dell, and this is in Rosemead. But she hears a noise behind her, and she turns around and sees a man with a gun, pointing the gun at her face. I mean, it's just so terrifying, and she raises her hand to shield her face and says, "Don't or stop." And he shoots the gun, and the bullet hits her on the hand. Unfortunately, is deflected by
off
her
keys.
Yeah. Which is just
incredible.
I couldn't believe it.
I know,
that.
She's so lucky. And, you know, especially in light of the fact that, and this is one of the things where I do believe that this crime actually gives a tremendous amount of insight. This is the first time we have a living adult victim who can tell us stuff, but also in combination with what happened to Dale, the fact that he laid in wait and shot her, you know, I mean, it's horrible, shot her right in the forehead. So he wanted to look in her eyes and pull the trigger and see the fear. That's a sadist. That's sadistic. And the fact that he did that and didn't account for the fact that she had a roommate who would be home momentarily tells me this is like that impulsive high risk behavior that typically ends up getting offenders caught right away. But this guy, by jumping from jurisdiction to jurisdiction to jurisdiction and by committing a vast array of different crimes, he was able to get away over and over and over and over again. it's not as much a testament to his brilliance or his skill level, but a testament to luck and the fact that there are multiple jurisdictions. Because if the same people are investigating all these crimes, they'll be put together faster. But the fact that different people are investigating all these crimes gave him an opportunity to slip into one jurisdiction and into another and into another one and back into the first one and out to another one. Big city, small town, big city. You know, he's all over the place. And this actually helped him get away with these crimes. Did he study how law enforcement works to decide on this pattern of behavior or lack of pattern of behavior? I don't know. He didn't strike me as a brilliant offender. And what I saw of him was just, he was incredibly ego-driven. And so this sadistic side of him must have been fueled and fed so much by these interactions that it drove him to do more and more and more because he got off on it.
They are very important observations. The fact that she, Dale, had hidden behind the counter and he waited for her to pop her head up and then he shot her point blank range, pretty much. I think it was from maybe it was 18 inches, but very close. The bullet was embedded in her skull. One of the other things, though, that I didn't appreciate from the Netflix show was that he had also pulled her blouse up. So it wasn't just about killing her. If we were working that crime scene, that would be a very important aspect to his behavior that we would want to understand. We don't know how long he was in the house for. Of course, Maria Hernandez said that she didn't lose consciousness. She was lying on the ground and pretended that she was dead. But how long was he in the house before? I always have the question, did he masturbate? Was there any form of sexual aspect to that behavior? And of course, we know the blouse was pulled up. And
yeah, that's sexual enough. That is sexual behavior, yeah.
But these things can be missed, can't they, Jim? And that's, again, what we have a lot of law enforcement listening to Real Crime Profile. It's very important to note these things and not just put it down to, well, maybe it was the way she fell and her blouse fell in a certain way. Mm-hmm. The fact that Maria just stayed on the ground, but when she did see him before he left, she ducked behind the car and she said, don't shoot me again, but she wasn't fearful. It sounded like she was quite bold and quite confident, and he didn't take the opportunity to try and shoot her, which I thought was very interesting.
It seems now, again, so strange.
I don't know why that was. Maybe he just felt that he'd spent too long there, that it was time to get out.
Or he's irrational as hell. I mean, he is irrational. Yeah.
It makes no sense. And I would probably go for the latter, that his decision-making doesn't make sense because I believe drugs are involved and or some kind of other aspect to his behavior. But I do think the sadistic part, that power and control, he certainly thrives off of that. That's an important part to understand about his behavior.
We entered the location on Village Lane. Dale Okazaki was lying on her back in the kitchen. She had sustained a gunshot wound to the head.
34-year-old Dale Okazaki had been unloading groceries when a man entered her apartment and executed her where she stood.
I can still see her today.
A couple of questions just about the order of events on that night. There are so many conflicting reports. Maria says that she is sure she was not followed home. There are other reports that say she was followed home, that RR saw her on the freeway and followed her home and then followed her into the garage. But Dale and she must have arrived within minutes of each other because Dale was already home unpacking her groceries. And then Maria arrived home, went to get into the house, and then RR enters the garage and stops her. I've been wondering if it was really Dale that he saw first and followed home and then waited like he was wont to do, waited and then saw Maria come home and went in. And the reason that I wonder that is because of Dale's ethnicity And it's just struck me that the first known murder victim that we know of being Mei Lung, and then Dale. Obviously, he had many other ethnicities of victims, but he had like over 11 Asian ethnicity murder victims. And that just really stuck out to me. And especially this hunting ground that he had just has a large community of Asian folks. And I mean, he didn't go to Chinatown and Thai town to select, you know, to hunt there. But I'm just wondering if in the back of his mind, he subconsciously is drawn towards that, because as we'll talk about later, his apprenticeship, if you will, with his cousin Miguel, who clearly murdered many Asian women and raped and murdered. Thank you. And I've just wondered that. I know Detective Carrillo wondered that too, before he was ever identified, as we'll see later in the night, he murders another Asian female. So I'm just wondering if in the back of his mind, he was drawn to that kind of a victim. I don't know if you had anything to say about that.
It's certainly possible. But again, we're trying to superimpose order over something that is chaotic. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know that we could ever exactly understand what he was thinking and why he was doing it. But certainly there does seem to be and I want to call it preference, but a number of Asian victims. And the next victim being Dai Lian Yu, who he yanked out of her car and shot her and left her in the street. Just literally like a practical kill, you know.
It's like 40 minutes later after he kills Dale Okazaki.
And it could be that he was trying to steal a car and he was unable to get one. And he felt like, I mean, maybe sirens were blaring and he needed to get out of there. So he does not give a fuck.
Well, according to witnesses, he was following her on the freeway, according to the witnesses who saw this, and that she pulled over and was saying, "Why are you following me? What do you want?" And then he tried to pull her out of the window. She fought back and he got into the car and just shot her point blank in the side.
Not in the car, though. He got her out of the car.
She climbed out of the car after he was sitting next to her and shot her in the side. And then she opened the door and was able to get out and call for help. I mean, that's the account that I've read. Again, there are so many conflicting, but this is from eyewitnesses who saw her crying for help and tried to help her.
Well, my eyewitness was a man called Joseph Duenas, who was sat in the car with his girlfriend at the time. And I'll just tell you what he said, because he called the police. He saw, as you described, bumper to bumper, RR hitting the back of her car. And he got out of his car, pulls her out of the car as she's fighting him all the time. But he shoots her once, but he shoots her at point blank range, execution style, and he wants to look in her eyes. That was the account. Now, Joseph Duenas said that he called the police. He did get the registration number of the car that RR was driving. And unfortunately, by the time the police arrived, Tsai Lian Yu was breathing but unconscious, and she later stopped breathing. But she had been shot twice in the chest at close range and was pronounced dead at the hospital. So to me, it sounds quite different. He could have shot her through the window, for example. Mm. We know killers that do that. If he wanted the car, shoot her, pull her body out, get in the car. To me, again, it's difficult to try and rationalize it, because it's so soon after the other offense where he's killed a woman. And yet he is seemingly is doing this without purpose, without motive, other than for the kill itself. So it's very hard to say anything rational about it.
Right. He may have seen her and just it triggered a desire on his part to kill someone else. Or he may have said, "She's a weakling. I could take her car and that will be my way of getting away." Who knows? But it's just impossible at this point to, like you said, Laura, just superimpose logic on something that is clearly illogical. But there is a definite lack of any kind of empathy for other humans, which puts him high on the psychopathy scale. And also the other two shootings that he had done just 40 minutes earlier, they indicate that we're dealing with a sexual sadist. You know, the fact that he sexualizes the threat and then the execution of Dale, the fact that he sexualized the fear that he caused in her and the wanting to look in her eyes when he pointed the gun at her and shot her in the forehead, that tells me this man is a sexual sadist and gets off on that sexually. And so he's a broad spectrum of offender, and he is committing a number of crimes for very different reasons, but he's doing them in this almost spree-like manner. And that is somebody that typically has mental disorders and somebody who is embracing the aspect of taking advantage of and violently killing people.
And I would imagine that that power and control, that high that he gets, he's looking to recreate. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's as simple as that, that he's in Dale's home address, and the reality and fantasy, as we know, Jim, it doesn't go to plan of what he wants, and he still doesn't feel as satiated, or whether he's trying to recreate what happened. But it can be as simple as she's driving along, say, Lian Yu, and she looks at him a certain way, or side-eyes him, yeah, and he gets affronted by that. I've seen that happen. Mm. You don't know it's that little micro aspect of behavior where someone feels it's a challenge to their authority. And who does that bitch think she is? She's going to pay for that. Who does she think she is, treating me like that or thinking she's better than me? And it can be as simple as that transaction that we never know anything about. What we do know about him is he does go out stalking, and he does watch people, and he does pick off people through the stalking behavior. And I've heard the stalking described so many different ways by people: out prowling, out watching, out looking to see if they can get a woman for sex, rather than using that word stalking. But the mm-hmm. stalking, if it is predatory stalking, the actual watching is like a sexual high in and of itself. It's the fact that they know what's probably going to happen to the victim, but the victim has no idea. And that right. in itself can be very sexually powerful, as all of this is about power and control, the high of feeling godlike, that I get to choose whether you live or die. And the sadistic part of him, I think all of that psychopathology plays in, but the rationality of the decision-making, I mean, it's all over the place, and how prolific he is of two or three, at least, that we know in one night. It's off the scale that he's looking to recreate this buzz or this high or whatever it is that he feels he gets from desecrating people like this. But he has no respect for other human beings, probably not for himself either. Importantly, those two murders were linked through the 22 caliber bullet recovered that had firstly been fired into Dell's skull from 18 inches and also from Cai Lian's body. So they were forensically linked. But of course, they were in very close proximity as well, and within a very short time period.
And what's crazy is, at this point, there are eyewitnesses to this crime, and still he gets away. And still they don't have any suspects. And still he's able to just go on and commit even more horrific acts right away.
Yeah, I'm curious about that, Jim, because of the witness that said he had the full vehicle registration license. So was it a stolen car?
It probably was a stolen car, yeah. I would imagine.
You would imagine it was, yes.
But still, being able to describe him, you know, a description of him, even if it was silhouetted, because he does have a very unique physique.
Distinct, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm not happy that he was able to go on and commit dozens and dozens more.
And just a little bit about Cai Lian Yu, who was also known as Veronica. She was studying at the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena. Beautiful place. I've been there many, many times. She lived with her parents. She had lots of friends. She loved visiting with her friends, and she loved her parents. And she, you know, they're just devastated by her death. If you can believe it, we have even more victims to talk about, and it just seems each one is more horrific than the last. So we will be back to honor these victims.
Till next time, signing off from Real Crime Profile.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.